Welcome in. Your boy Doug Gottlieb here. This is All Ball. Now remember, you can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays, 12 to 3 Pacific Coast time, 3 to 6 Eastern time. You can stream us, foxsportsradio.com, like, you know, if you're working at home now, or you can use the iHeartRadio app. You can download the pod as well. It's Doug Gottlieb Show. Anyway, my guest for this pod of All Ball is Scott Drew. He's head coach at Baylor. They had a great year. They won 23 consecutive games, almost. They did lose three of the last five. We want to talk about them getting ready for the tournament, but I want to talk about his kind of upbringing. He went to Butler, where he kind of studied to be a coach, coached under his dad, then coached with his brother and his dad when his brother hit one of the most memorable shots in the history of college basketball. There is a ton to get to with him. So without further ado, let's get to Scott Drew.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Well, let's welcome him in. He's the head coach of the Baylor Bears, who were ranked at one point in time number one in the country. They beat Kansas at Kansas. But, you know, like so many elite teams in college basketball, we kind of feel unfulfilled. Didn't get the Big 12 tournament chance to win the rubber match against KU, maybe in the Big 12 tournament. Of course, didn't get a chance to get to their first Final Four under Scott Drew. He joins us. How are you dealing with everything, with the shortened season, with your family, with your team, all of this stuff that's been going on in the kind of week and a half, 2 weeks since everything was canceled? How are you handling it?
Well, I can tell you one thing. God did not equip me to be a homeschool teacher, that's for sure. So so with the kids, I got a 9, a 12, and a 15-year-old doing homeschool right now. That is definitely not my biggest strength. The good thing is mom's taking care of business, making sure they're doing well, and then I've been focusing on making sure our guys are all taken care of. We're about 40% on campus, 60% at home, and making sure they're set up for their online classes, knowing how to handle that, do that, when they need to do that, and then making sure they're getting enough food and whatever they need to make sure they're in good health.
Okay, that's fascinating. Okay, so you do have kids on campus. Nowadays, you know, it's different than, you know, like my freshman year at Notre Dame when you had a roommate actually in the room, right? Like when I was at Oklahoma State, you had your own room, then you had like a common area, and then I had my off-campus apartment my junior and senior year. What's the living situation for your kids that are still on campus?
Good question. So nowadays, you know, so many kids are from international countries. Some of them are in from cities that are more infectious right now than where we have in Waco. So the ones that have stayed are in apartments right now, and our apartments are on campus or close to campus. So their living is normal, but what's changed is making sure they have places to eat. From the standpoint, our nutrition center is no longer open, and making sure that they have restaurants or different locations is, as you know, everything's kind of shifted to carry out, but making sure that they know where to go, and we have a thing called Bear Fuel where they can go with their school Bear Fuel to get meals where they're not coming out of pocket, and then obviously what restaurants are still open around them that they can go eat, because at the end of the day, college kids, we got to make sure they're eating proper nutrition, as you know.
Right. No, it's crazy, right? Like, so you guys have this incredible training table, but you can't have it open now. So now you're just trying to get kids fed, and the thing you're trying to keep them away from is the only thing that's kind of available, right? Like, you want to keep them away from the carry out, the takeout, the fast food, whatever, but that's the only stuff going. Okay, what about you guys have a spectacular basketball facility. Can they go in by themselves? Do you let them go in with a manager? How are you managing the shutdown in terms of guys wanting to get some work in?
Well, and that's where, as you know, pretty much every major conference and school is followed suit and closed down all the facilities. So no longer are they allowed to be in the practice gym, the weight room, the locker room, any areas, and that's all been closed off. So for a while, there were some church gyms open in town where guys could go work out by themselves or work out with two people on each end or whatnot. But now they've, with our, each city has different mandates. In our city, with the shutdown now, none of that is open. So it is old school. There's some outdoor parks where, as long as they're there by themselves or one other person rebounding, where they're staying spaced and we're not playing pickup or not doing twos or threes or getting into any large group or anything over 10 or people they don't know, but a lot of them right now in pairs, groups of two will go, and one will rebound, one will shoot, and then they'll flip. So that's what they're doing right now, and that's all weather permitting, of course.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, at least you're in Texas, you guys. We've had a weird, wet, really wet spring, but it's, you know, everything is just so incredibly different. All right, let's go back. We'll get to this year because there's a lot to butt into. Your dad, like my dad, you know, your dad was more of a basketball legend and obviously lifer.
Your dad was a legend now.
Yeah, he's very he was on the all lobby team. I think 10 years running at the Final Four. His polo shirt is retired in the lobby Hall of Fame at the Final Four. Okay, so if you were to close your eyes and say, growing up, my life was like this. Like, what's the image of what people should see the Drew family growing up?
Well, it was probably playing basketball in the backyard, 1-on-1, 2-on-2, or it was at my dad's gym. Playing basketball, baseball, football, whatever you could do in a gym. So one thing that your dad and my dad, I think, did a great job of is that was they involved their lives with ours and allowed us to be a part of theirs. And because they allowed us to experience and spend time with us through their work, it made us appreciate it and like it and want to be a part of it. So I think it's a great testimony to what both our parents did by wanting us all to be a part of the basketball realm of things. If they would have done their own thing, kept us away from it, not involved us, then you probably wouldn't have been in basketball. Me and my brother wouldn't have, your brother wouldn't have. So that's why I think, again, I was blessed, like you, to have a dad that involved us.
You grew up basically in South Bend, right? Because your dad was at Bethel, which, for people mm-hmm. don't know, Bethel is in South Bend. It's an NAIA school. In South Bend, what was that like? Because that's you were like 6 through 17, right? Before you went to, and then you went to Indiana South Bend for a year. Then you obviously went to Valpo right about when you were getting ready for college. So when you say my dad's gym, that's going over to Bethel College, you, your brother, and messing around. That's early life.
And my sister, yeah. What was great was it was an NAIA school, so it was a gym that was smaller, and it was kind of like you felt like you had your own gym because it wasn't a lot of seats. It wasn't one of those 5,000 seat arenas. It was probably like maybe 1,000 people. So it was mostly just a court and a stage, and then bleachers on the side. So it was perfect. You had the stage where that was the home run wall, and when you're playing wiffle ball, football, that was your end zone. Basketball, I mean, obviously you had your during that time, they didn't use the gym for besides basketball practice, really. And you know, back in those days, you only practiced during season. So out of season, you really had like a kid growing up. You had your own gym. So it was awesome. My dad would be in the office working, and then he'd come out and play with us, and then he'd go back to work. Or you come out and break up fights, whatever,
so you know, like that's one of the other gyms in South Bend I've actually been to, because I think Notre Dame, they never built a basketball facility, but they have another gym called the Pit inside the arena, and then they have other auxiliary gyms in there. But for graduation in wintertime, everything's closed up, so we went over to Bethel and we practiced for a couple of days. What do you remember about your dad's teams? How did they play when he was at Bethel?
Oh, well, they were most NAIA teams are very guard oriented. If you had a 6'5" guy or a 6'8" guy, you were that's a great big at that level at that time. So it was mostly guards, and that means a lot of long shots, a lot of pressing, a lot of passing. Back in those days, it was more less ball screen stuff, less isolation, more ball movement, more screens off the ball. But again, their teams were, usually they won, from my recollection, 20-plus, and usually it was 25-plus games a year. So they were really successful. And as you know, from being in Indiana, there's a lot of good basketball at the NAIA level, and the national tournament was always in Tennessee, Chattanooga, and I think it was at Temple University, and great memories growing up going down there when they played in the national tournament.
Why did he go to, do you remember why he, I mean, I probably should ask him, why did he go to Indiana South Bend for that 1 year before going over to Valpo? What led to him leaving? Because
he
was a long time.
Good question. So when he left Bethel, I think it was he felt like he had virtually accomplished everything he could there, and IUSB was trying to start a program, and had a chance to, with the resources, to maybe grow into something more. And I think the challenge of that probably excited him. And then at the same time, it's not like you have to move cities or anything, so you get that breath of fresh air, new challenge, and a new opportunity, and yet you're not uprooting everything. So that's why I think he went there. Originally, he was at LSU as an assistant with Dale Brown back in the day, and I think my mom tells a story. He was gone like 156 nights his last year, and he came home one night, and me and my brother and sister were like, thought he was a burglar because, he was never around much. So at that point, really, you and I know how the basketball profession works. I mean, he was on the fast track to be a young head coach at Division I level, and virtually gave that up so he could go to an NAIA school and spend more time with us as kids. And the longer the more we've grown up and been around the profession, that was a heck of a sacrifice he made for the family, and hence I think why my brother and I and sister are so appreciative.
Why'd you go to Butler?
Well, at the time, Valpo had never had a winning season in Division I basketball, and Butler was you had Barry Collier, you had Jay John, Thad Motti, you had some a more established program, very good coaches, and it was a great opportunity for me to learn from someone besides my dad, and I was able to still this day, Jay John came to one of our practices a couple weeks ago, and Thad Mata had an unbelievable career, and Barry Collier really started and transformed the Baylor basketball program. So when I came and worked for my dad, I was able to actually bring some different ideas or different thoughts rather than not having that opportunity.
So your plan the whole time was, hey, I want to be a basketball coach, and then I'll go learn from somebody else and then come back and work for you. Like, there was a whole plan. Like, did you sit down with your dad? This is what I want to do. Did everybody just know that's what you want to do? Like, how did, look, I remember when I was 17, 18, I actually graduated high school at 19. I had, like kind of three-pronged plan, right? Like, I wanted to play and make the NBA or play as long as I could. And then I either want to coach or be a broadcaster. That there was a thought that went into everything, who I played for, how they're connected, et cetera. Is that how you decided to go to Butler? And ultimately, you wanted to be a coach, and that's one of the reasons you chose that as a school.
Well, and that's one of the things I started doing even when I was at Butler. I'd coached one of my brother's summer teams. I'd coached one of my sister's summer teams. So I knew that's something that I just always loved doing, and partly because some of my first memories, we talked about growing up and playing with brothers and sisters in the gym and going to camp and running camp and all that stuff at an early age. But what I also remember as one of my first memories with my dad was going recruiting, and I thought it was so cool. But we got I was sleeping, and next thing I knew, I woke up, and there's these lights going on and off, and he had gotten pulled over for speeding. And I thought, you know, this is kind of like a amusement park or something. Can you do that again, Dad? But that was some of my first memories going recruiting with my dad, keeping stats, probably getting him popcorn and candy bars or whatever. But that's something he just involved with us, and it kind of like you think that's what you do, you know? I mean, that's life all summer long. You're going to camps, you're working camps, you're running camps, you're doing this, and that was just kind of life with our family.
Your favorite? Did you only do his camps, or did you go away to any other camp?
No, mostly his, because I had to work them too. But I went to Valpo University's camp. I worked Notre Dame's camp because that was close, and you could work both camps. Back in the day, you know how camps were. They were 7 days a week, and it was for 2 months straight, it seemed like. And at the end of summer, you were like, thank goodness we got school.
Oh, man, camp legs. The hard part was trying to play basketball after doing a day of camp. Like, you get those camp legs, and you're just...
I mean, remember camp? You weren't hooping. You were working on fundamentals. I mean, you're doing
learning fundamentals, and
you're doing jump stops and ball handling. You're like, dang.
And your whole equilibrium is thrown off because you know they're going. You got to manage them in the dorms. You got to get them to eat. You know, you got to they got to go. Sometimes they got to swim. All the camp stuff. Okay, so you're at Butler. You mentioned Barry Collier. You mentioned Jay John. What about Barry Collier? How did that, because, you know, like, look, Brad took him to the finals twice, and obviously he took him to heights no one could have seen. You know, they've had kind of a laundry list of amazing, amazing coaches. But Barry took them their first Sweet 16, and now he's the athletic director. What was he like as a coach? If you were trying to relate, this is why Barry Collier worked, what would it be?
Well, Barry was probably one of the most organized people you could be around. He was somebody that everything was down to the second, very detailed, no stone left unturned. You kind of like think of a factory. I mean, everything was well-oiled and an assembly line. I mean, very structured and disciplined. And you know what? That's harder to do with the lower levels at that time because you didn't have as many support staff as you might have at some other schools. And I mean, just how he ran everything was probably from similar to his Stanford influence and Mike Montgomery as far as organization goes and whatnot. But that's what I remember most about him.
So you get done in school. Right, at 93 that you graduated?
93, and then I took a job with my dad as restricted earnings coach, making $600 a month and living at home because that's the only place you could afford to. But my dad made me get my master's, so that was part of the deal. And hence, if you and I know by that time, after you finish college, you really aren't excited about studying anymore. So I actually got my master's in 1 year. And later they changed it so no one could do that again. But knocked that thing out, and then was very blessed and fortunate from the standpoint I was able to become a full-time assistant at a very young age. I think I was the following year, so I was like one of the youngest assistants, if not the youngest in the country. And
you're getting ahead of me a little bit because in trying to go back and look, like, when your dad got to Valpo, Valpo was terrible, and his first 4 or 5 years, they were still terrible, right? Like 10 wins first year, then 4, 5, 5, 12, and then I should point out that his first 21 season correlated with you as restricted earnings coach, okay? So you come over from Butler, and Butler was in the horizon at the time. You guys are in the mid-con. As you point out, Valpo hadn't had a winning season, let alone 20 win seasons, hadn't been in the NCAA tournament ever. Playing that little place called the Arc, right? And then, for people who don't know where Valpo is, what is it, 30 minutes outside of South Bend? Is that right? 30 or 40?
It's about 50 minutes. You know, with speed limits, they keep raising it, so you might make it in 45 or 30. But it's kind of between Chicago and South Bend.
Right, right. And Chicago South Bend with no traffic is hour and a half, and it's slightly off to the side there. So, you know, you're not like 15 minutes from Chicago. You're still probably an hour from Chicago. And anyway, but it's kind of a 30,000 people on like a college truck stop sort of town, right? Whereas South Bend's a bigger city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why did it take, in your opinion, and I know you weren't there during the bad years, but you're sharing all the information, all the stuff with your dad. Why did it take him? I mean, obviously it turned.
Yeah.
Why did it take him so long? And then what made it turn to being the kind of behemoth that it was?
Yeah, great question. So the first thing is when he took the job, Digger Phelps had told him, don't go there. No one has ever won there. No one will ever win there. It's a dead-end job. So that kind of excited my dad because my dad loved challenges. So Digger was trying to help him, like, don't go there. And he actually excited him to go there. But as you know, no matter what type of coach you are, you're never going to win without good players. And it takes time to get, when I say good players, players that fit your system, fit your style, your culture, and then are athletic enough and talented enough to win. And so the first couple of years, it took him some time. They had some good players, but not as enough depth, not enough to do the things that he wanted to do. And really what happened was what kind of changed the program was Casey Schmidt was a transfer from Arizona University, and David Redmond was a transfer from Arkansas Little Rock, and both of them were from Valparaiso High School. And then Tracy Gibson was an outstanding player from Michigan City Rogers. So you had three local kids that Tracy came to Valpo right away, and by his junior, senior year, is one of the best players in the conference. And then you added David and Casey, and they became eligible that first year that I was there. So right away, they had the talent at that time to be successful, and from there, things kind of took off because once you establish a program, it's a little easier to keep it rather than actually get one going. And I can tell you, the first year that I was there, I remember Brad Underwood was at Western Illinois, and both of us were the doormats of the MidCon. And at that time, Tony Bennett and his dad, Dick Bennett, Green Bay, that was like the cream of the crop, and UIC was very talented and good, and I mean, you had the Cleveland States, the Wright States, but I remember Brad and I talking, and we're like, one day we're going to be at the top, and the irony is, and I know I'm a fast forward and we can come back, but the irony is, I think it was Valpo and Western Illinois in three straight MidCon conference championship games. And it took us both a number of years to get there, but we did get there.
Well, it also helped that your brother is the best player in the history of Valpo, and
yeah,
hold on, I want to get to that. Okay, so your brother is class of 94, I believe. And I was class of 95, and so Notre Dame would not have been an option had your brother simply gone there, a town he grows up in. John McLeod was the coach then. It wasn't Digger that had been handed over, and obviously everybody wanted your brother, and he stayed home to play for your dad and you. What was that? You know, I'm going to have him on at some point. He can tell his side of the story, but I'm sure you move back home. Here your brother is, burgeoning All-American. Your dad's trying to turn the program around. Take me through how that actually played out.
Well, it was real easy. We told him if he wanted to be in the family's will, if he ever wanted to get a Christmas gift, if he ever wanted to do anything with us, he had to come to Valpo at the time. So we got that done. in all seriousness, what had happened was as Bryce became a better player, he got recruited and took official visits from Stanford to Notre Dame to Syracuse and was Mr. Basketball in the state of Indiana. And so he could have gone anywhere. And up to that time, remember, Valpo had never won. And the year that he's finishing up high school, Valpo wins 20 and actually has a chance to maybe get to an NCAA tournament. And you're like, man, you can win here. And he signs late, and I think because both coincided, and what I mean by that is if Valpo had won five or six games, I don't know if my dad would have been as excited about Bryce going to Valpo from the standpoint he wanted to play in the NCAA tournament. He wanted to have a chance to accomplish his goals and dreams of being a part of March Madness and playing against other quality teams and winning. And what it did the year before he got there, by us getting close and winning 20 games, it was like, hey, you know what? We can get to the tournament. We can be a successful program. You can come here and be a winner. And I think that all coincided with him finishing his career. He visited those schools, and as we ratcheted up the heat, I think I started making his bed for him, and my mom made his favorite breakfast every day, and next thing you know, we got the commitment, and the irony is we didn't have a scholarship at that time, so he was probably the best walk-on in Valpo history, or maybe in the state of Indiana, walk-on history. and then the sophomore year, he got a scholarship. I believe that's how it worked.
Okay, so then what was that dynamic like? Like, look, you've always gone in the gym and been with your dad. You'd coached Bryce in AAU, but now all of a sudden, as you point out, you get bumped up to being an assistant. Your dad's a head coach. Bryce is a freshman, a team that had already won 20 games. What was that experience like early on?
Well, I remember one thing that I'll pass on to any other coach's sons out there. Dick Bennett, Tony Bennett, one thing that they'd given great advice to my brother, and that was if there's a real tough practice, stay in the gym and shoot, because when you go in the locker room, people are going to be upset with your dad, and it's easier if you're there not to hear about that. So I thought that was really good advice, and Ron Hunter and his son, RJ, when he was going to coach him, he had asked for the same advice, and I wish my brother and dad hadn't been so honest, because remember, RJ hit the shot to upset us in the first round, and I don't know if we really needed him being on that team looking back at things, but that is really good advice for other coaches' sons out there. After a tough practice or when the players are mad at your dad, don't go in the locker room until they've had a chance to shower, cool down a little bit, because that puts you in a bad position. But research from other coaches and sons, what advice, what thoughts, and basically I had always worked out my brother, so what was great was after every practice I'm going to work him out extra anyway, and so he just lived in the gym and was able to, because back in those days you didn't have near the restrictions you do nowadays with 20 hours practice time, all that kind of stuff, and he was really able to improve his first year. And one thing I'll tell you too is you and I know teams that love one another, care about one another, they compete harder for each other. Well, who are you going to play harder for than your dad, you know, or your brother? And I think that made me want to recruit harder and make sure he had better players around him and a better team. And I'm sure my dad did the same thing, because we didn't want to let him down, because when he came to Valpo, he could have gone to a lot of other perceived programs that were better, and he turned down those opportunities to play with us. And at the end of the day, 4 years go by, he wins four regular season conference championships, four conference tournament championships, and actually I saw this the other day on CBS or ESPN, there were three schools that have won 10 or more straight, I think, conference championships or conference tournament championships, and Valpo's one of them, I think Murray State's one of them, and then Gonzaga's the other one. So that mark's still around today.
Amazing stuff. 1998, I was in Lexington, Kentucky. We had played the first game of the day against George Washington and won. Shante Rogers was their point guard. Mike Jarvis was their head coach. We get
hey,
back
it wasn't
to the
fun handling it against him, was it?
It wasn't bad. They had it was a weird team. They had, you know, he was like a 5'6", 5'7" point guard, and then they had all these giant Russians.
So he was okay, that quick and on ball defender.
Yeah, he was good. I mean, that stuff didn't really bother
affect
me,
you?
Right? Like,
okay.
No, because people, you know, there wasn't a point yet where people played way off me, but. No, ball pressure didn't really, really bother. I mean, we felt like we were massively underseeded because we won the South back when the Big 12, as you remember, was separated North and South.
Uh-huh.
And then we lost to Texas. Tom Pender's last win, he played slow for the first time. and they upset us in the Big 12 tournaments. We got like an 8 seed, and we should have been like a 4. Like, we were ranked the whole year. It was real, but we played a soft schedule. Anyway, we get back,
okay,
and we throw on Ole Miss. Valpo is on, and the reason we're all watching is I got Adrian Peterson's our best player. He's from Little Rock, Arkansas. Alex Weber's on our team. He's from Searcy, Arkansas, and they have Keith Carter's an Arkansas kid.
Yes.
You know, they have, remember, this Ansu Cisse was on that team, Jason Smith, Anthony Boone, who's now the head coach, I think, at Central Arc. He was the interim, now named full-time head coach. Mike White, who's the head coach at Florida, of course, was their point guard. Anyway, all of our guys knew all of their guys.
Yeah.
And their staff knew our staff, et cetera, et cetera. So we throw on the game, and it's in Oklahoma City at the Myriad, which is next to the Chesapeake Energy Arena now where the Thunder play. And we're watching Bryce and your team, Jamie Sykes and Bill Jenkins and the rest of the team. What do you forget? We'll get to Pacer and the play. What do you remember about the game? Nobody ever talks about that game. They only talk about the play. What do you remember about the game?
Well. First of all, what I remember as a coach was we went to an early shoot around that day, and I remember it was a big question: do you go to shoot around, not shoot around? Because it was an early game, so the shoot around was like 7 a.m. And I remember having great energy, and early bird gets the worm and all that stuff, trying to motivate your guys. But what I really thought was driving into the tunnel, I was thinking, you know, this could be the last time I coach my brother. And it really hit me. I was like, dang, I don't want it to end. And with that senior class, Bill and Bob Jenkins, Jamie Sykes, they'd won 4 straight conference and conference tournament championships, but they had never won an NCAA tournament game. And they'd been really close the year before, got out to a great start against Boston College, and I believe Coach O'Brien was coaching, and they had the big fella, the 6'7", monster inside.
Billy
Abrams.
Curley? Oh, no, Danny Abrams. Donnie Abrams.
And so we, the first half, my brother hits like 5 or 6 threes. And we're up double figures, and everything's going great, and then they go to a box and one. and we weren't really ready for that, you know? and not that we hadn't been boxed and one before, but you don't expect a Big East school to do that, you know? And they end up winning at the end of the game, so we've been close. And this game was, Ole Miss was back and forth, and at the end, What a lot of people don't realize is, like, with 12 seconds or 13 seconds to go, we come down. My brother has a great look from three. I mean, a great look. And he misses in and out. And we foul right away on the rebound. So if he hangs his head, if the team doesn't know to foul right away, well, then you don't even get to the next point of the game. Now, it's a 2-point game at the time, so if he hits that three, we're up one with, 10, 12 seconds to go, but we miss. So now you come back down, and they're shooting free throws at, like, 5 seconds or something, and Ansu Cisse's just got to make one to go up three, and he misses both. But when he misses the second one, we don't get a clean rebound. More time comes off the clock. You'd mentioned Keith Carter, an outstanding player, but he had a long wingspan, was athletic. He's over the ball, and with 2.5 seconds, everybody knows out of timeouts to line up in Pacer. And Jamie Sykes is a baseball player, so the first thing is he's going to throw a great pass. But he pump fakes to get Keith up in the air because of his wingspan, he needed to. So now when what goes up must come down. When he's coming down, you're throwing the pass. Bill Jenkins is a great athlete, was a volleyball player back in the day, and really could jump, did a great job going up in traffic, catching it. And then obviously my brother knocks it down, and the irony is he thought the shot was short, and he said God's angel lifted that over because he really thought it was short. And then when it goes in, time expires. He dives on the floor, and everyone wants to know, why'd you dive on the floor? Well, you had Bill Jenkins running one way, Bob the other way, so that's like 2 6'6" guys that bench press over 300 pounds. You got to hit the floor. And then everybody jumps on top of the pile, and you go into the locker room, you celebrate. And this was before, I mean, now, this is before before cell phones. This is old school, right? So you go back to the hotel, and everybody's going crazy. You're watching the highlights. You got all the interviews. Well, you got to unplug the phones from the wall of the hotel because reporters and people are calling all night long trying to get interviews, and they don't know who they're calling. They're just calling rooms. So you got to actually, we had to do bed check and make sure all the phones were undone. But it was a great night. I can tell you that for sure.
What's crazy about it, what's crazy about it to me is, I don't think anybody even realizes that then you had to go overtime to beat Florida State the next game. Like, it's almost like that moment is so big and so iconic. Well, like, whatever happened to Valpo? Like, you didn't lose the next game. You went and won the next game in overtime and then got to play Rhode Island, who was an unbelievable team, right? The team had beaten Kansas.
With Florida State, I can tell you one thing I remember, and this was when you remember you'd get to the arena and you'd watch the other teams, like as you're getting ready to get on the floor, they're finishing up practice. And I remember with that Florida State team, you probably already know all the roster because you know everything, but they had like four guys over 6'10" that could just dunk. And I mean, that whole team was so athletic, and they were doing a dunk thing at the end for the fans. And our guys were sitting there like, man, even their managers are dunking. Them guys are athletic. And I remember getting ready to play them. The only thing we said is, no dunks, all right, because we know they can do that real well. And again, that was a great team. Coach Robinson, I believe, coached that team. And we ended up winning that game in overtime. And then what transpired on the way before we played Rhode Island was we're coming back, and everybody flies commercial back in those days. And I remember we're coming back, and we're getting – pulling up on the campus, and literally we have to stop a block before getting to the Ark, which is the Valpo Arena, because it is packed with people, and so we didn't want to get off the bus because we didn't know what was gonna go on, and it was kind of like those movies where you have the rock stars pull up and everyone's shaking the bus and knocking on the windows, and it was like that environment. And the security guards came on and said, "We'll form a tunnel." So right away, us coaches being smart, we made Bill and Bob lead us through, and we just followed them because everybody got out of their way, and then went in and did a spontaneous pep rally, and then Rhode Island, what people don't realize was, remember Coach Herrick coached Rhode Island, and he'd already won a national championship at UCLA, but his son, Jim Herrick Jr., was on our staff for a year at Valpo. He'd run Reebok at the time, and he was on the staff. So basically, you had two Drews and a Herrick coaching against another Herrick, and that little Herrick. I mean, it was for serious bragging rights. That guy was more intense that week in practice than I have ever seen him because he did not want to lose to his dad. And that was a great game. Went down to the wire. They ended up winning. And I remember after we're condoling our team, the security guard knocks on the door. And he's like, "Coach, you're going to have to bring the team back." And he says, "What do you mean bring the team back?" He goes, "None of the Valpo fans have left the arena. You got to bring the team back and thank them or wave to them so that they'll leave the arena." And they just stayed out there chanting for the Valpo team to come back out. Players went out, acknowledged the crowd, and then they finally would leave the arena so the security guards could clean up. But that's what I remember about that one.
How did it work with your dad handing the job off to you? Did he get sick and that's why he had to step aside, or did he need a break? Because this is in, I'm going to say, what, 2001, 2002, right? He stepped aside for a year and you took over. How did that actually take place?
Well, he had at that point thought about, maybe do I get into administration and become an athletic director or assist with the president? But basically, he was needing a break from coaching, or wanted to see. He was young enough where do I do something else with the rest of my life? And he knew I wanted to be a head coach, and I know it was a great opportunity for me, and at the end of the day, I never would want him to step away to give me an opportunity, but I really thought that it was God's timing from the standpoint he wanted to pursue some other things, or at least see what else was out there, and he wanted to work on his golf game a little bit, and he wanted to do some things with the family, and so at that point, he steps down. I take over. He's a special assistant to the president, and then I coach for a year. And to just fast forward, after the year being out and basically figuring out his golf game wasn't going to improve that much, and that he liked working at the university and doing some different things like that, but at the same time he really missed the competitive part of basketball, and if the job hadn't opened at Baylor, he was at that point thinking about trying to get back into coaching or maybe the NBA, but he wanted to do something again with basketball. So it worked out perfect. After 1 year, I went to Baylor, and he was able to go back into coaching. And I think you've heard this sometimes, too. I mean, coaching is such a grind, and after doing it 20-30 years, it's kind of like teachers, you know, every how many years they do a sabbatical where they can refresh, or pastors do that, and I think that's what he was able to do, and then it worked out great. He's back coaching, and then my brother finishes up his playing career, and then he coaches with my dad, which my dad loves, and he gets an opportunity to help shape and mold Bryce's coaching career, and they have another great run at Valpo before he retires, and my brother takes over there.
When you took over the Baylor job, this is right about when I had started in media, and I had known some of the stuff that was going on before you got, like, no one knew kind of the depth of it or how they would handle it. But you know, it's about as it's about as bad a situation as anyone can walk into. How did it happen? Like, take me through. You're a head coach at Valpo. Taking over your dad's program, you do it for a year, and now you have this national story about Baylor, the nation's biggest Baptist school, and this terrible tragedy and all the things going on. How'd you get the job?
Well, first and foremost, it was different because the job wasn't filled until late August, right. And normally, as you know, most coaching jobs are filled in April. So we're getting ready to start our season. And Bob Bodine and his search firm, they were the ones that did the search. And Tim Floyd at that time had coached my brother with the Bulls and with the Hornets. And he had thought, he had reached out and thought that that would be a great opportunity and something similar to what my dad did at Valparaiso University, and being at Iowa State and knowing about Baylor and the Big 12, thought that that could be a really good situation for me. So I talked to the leadership at Baylor at the time and knew what their vision was for the program and how they wanted to do it, and prayed about it and felt led to go there. And my like you said, you had a three-prong goal list, and one of my goals was always to coach at a place where you could go to Final Fours and compete for national championships. And at Valpo and in mid-major schools, you can always do that, but obviously at Power Five schools, the percentages are greater to do that. And my dad had an opportunity to start and build a program, and I thought this was a chance for me to do the same thing. And I had had the blueprint and had spent a lot of time helping my dad with Valpo, so I felt very comfortable in being able to take on a challenge like that. And then from there, at the end of the day, you and I know there was a lot of work to do, so time kind of flew, and 1 year led to 2 years, to 3 years, to 4 years, and finally it was up and running, and now it is where it is today.
The first year you kind of take over and you just kind of try and make it work, right? And just kind of get it through. The second year was the year, which is the, when did you have six players?
So the first year, that's when we had like six scholarship players. We started the year, right. I think, at seven, and then or eight, and then we had some academic issues, some suspension issues, and you get down to six players. And the one thing I remember about the first year was the biggest thing we had to do was a walk-on tryout. We not only had to have walk-ons, but it was a walk-on dream. You could be on the team and play. So it was a great deal for walk-ons. And I remember going around campus, and we were trying to find anybody with height. And I remember Coach Driscoll and I one evening were at Fazoli's, and we're at the drive-thru on the way back to the office, and there's a 6'8 guy, and we're like, where do you go to school? And he's like, I go to Baylor. And I said, where do you live? You're a sophomore. You got to come to tryouts. And then never heard from him again. And then we spent the next week trying to find him, and obviously he didn't go to Baylor, otherwise we'd have found him. But we have this walk-on tryout, and we show up for the walk-on tryout, and when we get down there, there's some height and there's some athleticism, and we're like, whoa, where'd this come from? We're pretty excited. We call everyone over and we say, all right, we need to know what year you are at Baylor, where you live at Baylor, and one of the questions is, wait, we actually have to go to Baylor? And the answer is yes, you got to be a student here. So we had had kids from junior colleges. We had had people from Dallas. They had driven down thinking you didn't have to go to Baylor and you could just walk on the team at Baylor. So right away we had to get rid of all those people, and then tryouts went down to what they normally look like when you have a lot of walk-ons, and that's a lot of guys under 6'2", you know. So anyway, we went from real promising tryout to a little more reality, but we were able to find some guys that really worked hard, really competed, and really helped lay the foundation for the future recruits we brought into the program. And that year was a remarkable year from the standpoint nobody thought we'd win a game, and we ended up winning three games. And I can remember the celebrations in the locker room after each one of them. And when I say three conference games.
No, three conference, and the next year you won one.
Then reality came in once you start bringing in recruits. Now, we really didn't have a chance to recruit because by the time you take the job, it's late August, so most of the players had already committed, and then you're looking at a late signing period or getting transfers, and they have to sit out. So, as you know, it's hard winning with new players in the Big 12, let alone guys that probably weren't as highly recruited either.
No, well, then they had that thing your third year. You had no non-conference games, right?
And that was something, if anyone ever has that happen to them where they get only a conference season, we're the only ones, we're the experts, because we're the only ones that have ever gone through something like that. And that was probably one of the most difficult things is we recruited a really good class, a talented class, and that class kind of turned the corner as far as competing and winning and helped lead us to the NCAA tournament. But going into the locker room when we found out in year three that we weren't going to have a non-conference and telling the players that, and then seeing how bought in they were to the program that they were going to stay and practice and compete. And talk about a tough thing. I mean, imagine doing drill work and practices all the way up to January. I mean, that's not the easiest thing to do when everyone's having midnight madness and everyone's having opening night and everyone's having all their Thanksgiving tournaments and then the Christmas tournaments, and we're still practicing. So that was tough. And what was really hard about that, though, was here's how I equate it to when you're on the freeway, everybody's driving 65. In Texas, it might be 75. But when you're getting on the ramp to get on, you're going 40, then you go 50, 60, and you got to catch up. Well, that's what it's like when you don't play a non-conference schedule. I mean, you can drill till you're blue in the face, but games are different. As you know, the adrenaline's different, the energy's different, so we wait that long to play the first couple games, and then when you play the first couple games, you're terrible because you're just adjusting and getting used to playing, and that's why you play a non-conference to prepare you for conference. So the worst thing was seeing us not be successful after we'd waited that long to play games.
Was there ever a point, and that year, you know, not only did they, you're not allowed to play non-conference, but you open up the conference play on the road at Texas Tech.
Right?
What I think was coached by Bob Knight at that time.
Yeah,
right?
By Coach Knight, yes, sir.
Yeah. So hey, listen, no one on conference games. Then listen, we're gonna start you off on the road at Tech. Then And then home Eddie Sutton in Oklahoma State, and then you go on the road to Colorado. Those are your first three games.
And I might be wrong. I think we even got the bye. So I think the first week we might have had a bye. Then we went to Texas Tech because I think they had a bye that year. But I remember we started the game against Texas.
Yes, you started with the bye, so you didn't play till January 11th, and everybody else had played a game.
Like we needed a bye, huh?
Yes.
So the toughest thing was we start against Tech, and you know what? We come out. I think we score our first 4 out of 5 buckets. And then all of a sudden the wheels came off, you know. But we were pretty amped to play in the beginning of the game, that's for sure. It's kind of like running your first marathon, you know. You come out of the gates really fast, and you're like, oh, snap, I got 26 miles to still go.
So I would say that year, though, one of the guys who turned your program was Curtis Jarrells, right? And
yes,
CJ, if I remember, wasn't he from Austin?
He was from Austin. Henry Dugat was from Houston area, and then Kevin Rogers was from Dallas. And those three really did a great job in helping lead that rebuilding. And by the end of conference, they had shown the league that these guys were pretty talented and Baylor's going to be pretty good in the future.
You didn't make the tournament. You won, was it 28 games in 2009-2010? So how do you, if somebody's sitting at home, and that year you go all the way to the Elite Eight and Duke and the charge call, et cetera, et cetera. How do you do it? How do you turn a program from one that, you know, 5 years before didn't have a, you know, didn't have a non-conference game to winning 28 games and losing to the eventual national champions in a 1-2 possession game? How'd that change happen?
Well, I think everybody always talks about you got to have goals, you got to have dreams, you got to have visions, but it's the journey, it's the process. And every day, if you're just trying to do everything you can to get better that day, then before long, you're there. And I know, as corny as that sounds, I mean, we had so much work to do to bring in players, instill the culture, build what Baylor basketball is today, that people are like, didn't you get discouraged? Didn't you get down? Well, when you're that busy, you don't really have time to get down or discouraged, because you're just trying to make the most of each and every day, and then before long, you're there. And, I mean, there is no substitute for hard work, and there is no substitute for doing everything you can to win the day. And that's basically what we did, and it took a little longer than some places, but at the same time, my favorite stat, and it's going to change this year because North Carolina didn't win 18, but for the last 12 seasons, if you look at the Power Five, there's Kansas, North Carolina, Duke, and Kentucky. So now North Carolina will be out, and then you have Michigan State and Baylor are the only Power Five schools to win 18 or more games for 13 straight years now, since the season's over right now. And that's 13 years of a lot of consistency. And you and I know how hard it is to be consistent at this level year in and year out with all the transfers, the one-and-dones, and everything else that affects programs.
I would also say that run to the NIT Finals against Penn State, because you made the NCAA tournament, was in 2008, right? So you make the NCAA tournament, and all those guys you said, you know, Henry Dugat and Curtis Jarrells, mm-hmm, get a chance to play in the tournament. But then to see yourself winning in the postseason, and granted, the tournament's great, and it's an unbelievable accomplishment, but to win several games, win 4 or 5 games, and to get to a championship game where you're one of only a handful of teams still playing, I thought that was a big, big part of your program's build for the long term. And it really helped you the next year when you went to the Elite Eight.
Absolutely. That's the coaching in you right there, because going to the tournament's outstanding, but winning in postseason is just different. And if you win in the NIT and you get a chance to go to a Final Four in Madison Square Garden, that experience, if you ask players, most of them will tell you that's better than losing in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And, I mean, the NIT does an unbelievable job putting on a tremendous program, but there's something about win or go home mentality, winning in postseason. It's just different. And when you get to a Final Four, and with us, the first time we got into the NCAA tournament, I will tell you a quick story on that, and that is Joe Lunardi thought we were in, and so you feel like you're good when he says you're in. But this is in the beginning of his career, so he didn't have that long track record. But so we have CBS come, and they're broadcasting, you know, the selection show. And it's the first time Baylor's going to go to the tournament in 20 years, and we're the last team called. So we have about 1,000 people maybe there, filled the arena floor. We're all watching the selection show, and team by team by team by team goes. When you get down to the last team, and you, at that point you're like, what do we tell these people that are here expecting us to get in? And then you get in. I don't know if I've ever celebrated as loud and as hard for the next 5 seconds as I did right there. And that was a great accomplishment for Baylor basketball. Then what you said, winning in the postseason, that got that tradition going, and that definitely enabled us to have that Elite Eight run. But then a couple years later, we actually won the NIT championship. And I tell you what, cutting down the nets in Madison Square Garden, that's a memory that'll stick with those guys for a lifetime as well. And it goes back to what you said, winning in postseason is just special.
When did you, and I know like you didn't play nearly as much zone here last couple of years, but you started to become known for the zone. Where did that come from?
Well, we had in recruiting, we've always tried to attract the best players that fit our program and then adjust our style based on our personnel. So for a stretch there, we had a really long team. And when you had Anthony Jones at 6'10", 6'11", at the three, sometimes it's hard for 6'11 guys to guard guards. But you know what? You put them in a zone, it's hard for guards to score over them. And we've had some really big three men, from Anthony Jones to 6'10", Quincy Miller, Torian Prince at 6'8". Just with the length that we had, we started playing zone, and then we were successful with it too because we've had some elite shot blockers, and putting them at the rim like Epe Udo, that got us to the Elite Eight in 2010, and then 2012. So in 2010, you lose to Duke, who wins it all, and you're like, man, we could have won a national championship. Then in 2012, sorry, little man's done with homeschool and he's asking for recess. But in 2012, we have we lose to Kentucky, who ends up winning it all. And you're like, man, they were pretty good, Anthony Davis, but we were really good that year too. And we could have won it there. And then we went to the Sweet 16, lost to Wisconsin, who went to the Final Four. And then we were ranked number one and lost to South Carolina, who went to the Final Four. So we know it's just a matter of time. And obviously, we would have loved this year having a chance to be a number one seed, or obviously the highest seed if it would have been a one or even a two in Baylor history, to see if we could have broke through and won a national championship.
All right, so the bad part is that this team, you're going to lose Bandu, Gillespie, at least, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, there's a, you know, you have a handful of seniors. You have some other guys that have some decisions to make. Mm-hmm. But you know, Tristan Clark should be healthier next year with the knee, right? You would think, although
yes.
Maybe that's a side discussion for, here's a kid who's been rehabbing the knee and now he can't get around the trainers to help him rehab his knee. It's got to stink. But let's just talk this team, because this was you had this magnificent run over the last year and a half with most of this group. I've talked to Bill Self about it. Bill's like, and obviously their scale is different in Kansas. And his thing is, mm-hmm. you're not going to win a national title, get to a Final Four every year. You want to put yourself in a position where the bad years you compete for a league title, obviously his bad years, he's won a league title, but the bad years, and then there's some years where you just know, hey, we got a shot to win the whole thing. Coming mm-hmm. into this season, what were your personal expectations of your team?
Well, I thought we could win a national championship. But if you're asking me, did I think our team would win 23 straight games?
Yes, that's my question.
Did I think we would be ranked number one longer than anyone since Kentucky in 2015? Did I think we'd win 15 conference games? Did I think we'd win 15 conference games and not win a league title? The answer would have been you always have best case, you have worst case, and, right. and obviously when you win 23 in a row, that's best case because that means you've avoided injuries, you've had great depth, you haven't had you've had everyday guys, and I mean that you've been you understand the Big 12, you know the Big 12 as well as anybody, if not better, and I mean to break Kansas's record of 22 straight wins and get 23. I mean that record. Who knows how long this one will hold up? Because it's hard to win 23 straight games, especially in the Big 12.
Oh well, you know it's forget the home court advantage and the talent of the other teams. The coaches are fantastic. We used to have at Oklahoma State, like right before the season would start, coach would call us in, and all the assistants would be there. And we just kind of talk about, you know, like, what do you think your role is? What do the coaches think your role is? Do you guys have that? Do you have that with these guys? Like, because the thing that was most impressive, and again, this is from afar watching your team, is your team knew their roles. Now, granted, you allow a lot of your wings to have offensive freedom, so it's good to, but, you have one guy who doesn't really, you don't run any plays for Mark, and yet he played harder than anybody because he knew his role. How did you go about establishing roles, or did they organically take place by themselves?
Great question. And if it works, coaches should always take credit for it, correct? Because when it doesn't work, we definitely take the blame for it. But I would tell you that this is was a great group to coach from a couple standpoints. One, it was a real blue-collar, hard-working group that wasn't entitled. And, I mean, they were always in the gym, and they had great respect for one another because they saw how hard each other worked. And then because they were always together, they really liked one another, and then they enjoyed being together. So what happened was, we always say player-led teams are better than coach-led teams every day of the week and twice on Sunday. So this was a player-led team that did a great job. When someone was hot, they would feed them the ball. They'd put the ego aside because they really liked one another and I think cared for one another and respected one another. So it was easier for them to buy into their roles. And I mean, it was a team that wasn't, we didn't have a lot of seniors, but we had a lot of older guys. And sometimes it's easier for older guys to understand their roles and take their roles than somebody who maybe it's their first go around in college and doesn't have that experience. And this group, again, nowadays in college basketball, you know it with the parity each and every night, and one team just shows up with their B game and they get beat and it's not even close. And we lost some games, but you know what? We always showed up and competed, and that's a blessing as a coach.
You've also, look, you've had some very, very highly touted guys. The the highest ranked guy you have on this roster was Davion Mitchell, who went to Auburn, so he's a transfer. You know, he's been around your program. He gives him a chance to buy into the culture. I mean, like, look, there's no McDonald's All-Americans on this team. You've had them in the past. So I guess the question becomes, the expression is our kind of guys, like OKGs, right? Are these more your kind of guys? Does this stop you from recruiting the Uber elites in Texas and Louisiana, which you have gone after? Or is this simply, or is this just an outlier that you keep going after the big boys and you take who you can get? Like, because this was not the most highly touted crew.
I think the true question is who we think fits our program. And yes. Who we think is a good player for our program. And what I mean by that is sometimes you get a guy ranked 20th, and then you get a guy ranked 120th, and you're like, the guy 120th is going to produce and fit in and be a lot more effective player than the guy ranked 20th. But if you get the guy ranked 20th, everybody thinks it's a better player, better recruit, you're doing a great job. In actuality, really, if you're doing your job, you're bringing in the best for you and your program. So to answer that question, someone ranked number one in the nation and fits what we do, and we think, and what I mean fits what we do, we want guys that are going to want to work. We're going to want guys that are not going to be entitled. They're going to be coachable, and they want to get better, and they're great teammates. And it doesn't matter if you're ranked one or you're ranked 200. We want those qualities. And if you have those qualities, then you're going to fit in with us, because at the end of the day, you played on teams that you liked the guys, and you played on teams where you didn't really like the guys. If you like who's on your team, you've got a much better chance of winning.
No question about it. The Kansas win. Look, there's lots of wins you can get in the Big 12 which feel really good, right? You go into Ames and beat Iowa State. It's awesome. They got a great home crowd. Anytime you beat Texas and you're at Baylor, you know, Battle of the Brazos, whatever, you win those games, those are big. But to beat Kansas at Kansas, especially considering for you personally, like, Self has had your number.
he's had a lot of people's number.
he's had a lot. Listen, Eddie Sutton never won in Lawrence, Kansas. Ever. Never won a game in Fog Allen Fieldhouse. What was that like? What was that experience for a coach? Because you've accomplished everything outside of a Final Four, really. I guess winning the Big 12 tournament, but you know, you've done everything now from a program that had six players your first year and no non-conference games. But to win at Kansas, what was that like?
Well, I can tell you what was great was the celebration in the locker room afterwards and what the guys had been able to achieve. But what was really telling was I thought throughout the game, our guys never. I mean, we've been up there close so many times, and yep. What the difference was in this game when in the second half we were able to make a run, and then we never allowed Kansas to make their patented runs. I mean,
yep. I was sitting at home watching the game, thinking, all right, here comes Kansas, and then you guys did what no one does, which is you stepped on them. They had them down. Yeah. Everybody else lets them back in. The crowd gets going crazy. There's a 50-50 call that they always get. They make a bunch of free throws, and they find a way to force overtime. Like Bob Huggins, like every year it's on repeat for the poor guy. And you guys didn't let that happen.
You've seen some games up there. I like your analysis.
Yes. They're all the same.
You know when that crowd all the gets same. Going, it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah, people are like, I don't get it. Like, it's not like, and they don't, sometimes they get a lot of calls. They might just get one that's a backbreaker, but you guys never let them ever really think they had a chance. That was the really, okay, let's get to Kansas did beat you at your place. You were going in the Big 12 tournament and you had lost 3 out of 5. Had people in the league figured out how to guard you?
Well, I think a couple things. One, Kansas at our place, I thought their adjustments were really good. In a close game, you got to make free throws. That's one thing we did not do. We did not do it at TCU.
Against TCU either, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And if you're going to win a close game, you have to make free throws. And what I mean make free throws is you got to shoot around 75, 80%. You can't be in the 50s or 60s and win many close games. But I thought Kansas really made some good adjustments. And I thought probably like up at their place, they had some shots that they missed. They did some things that you're like, man, can't believe we missed that, or that's a good look. So what I would have loved, I know we were really excited about the Big 12 tournament from the standpoint, I think we had some adjustments now that we wanted to see how they would adjust our adjustments. Does that make sense? Yeah. And it's hard coming off a game where you play, you win up there, you're so successful, you're not going to change a lot. Even though they had changed some of their things, you don't change as much usually when you have a pretty successful win, you know? And Bill is a great Hall of Fame coach, does a tremendous job, and their teams don't beat themselves. So you got to beat them, and up there you said we didn't allow them to make a run, and unfortunately at our place we couldn't put together a run at the end of the game either. So would have loved to have a third crack at it. I thought going into the last five games, we were a little banged up. Everybody's banged up, but I thought we had a chance going in the Big 12 tournament to be healthier than we'd been in a while. And we had a chance to actually have some good competitive practices, to where I thought we had an edge about us that we hadn't been able to have in a while. So, again, those teams that beat us, We were looking forward. I think we were hungry. I think we were excited to play. I think we were getting healthier than we'd been, and we had an edge. So I'd have really liked to see what we could have done in the Big 12 tournament.
You guys are an elite defensive team and an elite defensive rebounding team. What had you changed, or what had you emphasized this year that really worked with this team? Because the defensive and defensive rebounding numbers are off the charts great. I mean, right? Like, well, we always talk about the ball going through the net, but the numbers are spectacular.
Yeah, I think if you look at rebounding numbers for probably the last 7-8 years, especially on the offensive end, have been really good. Defensively, we got better the last couple years to go along with our offensive numbers, especially in conference play. I believe last year we finished first and first in rebounding, or second and first in offense and defensive rebounding. But what fit our personnel was an aggressive man-to-man, and that's when you have Mark Vidal, who's up for Defensive Player of the Year, Final Four. Davion Mitchell was top 10. And then in Big 12 voting, we had Freddie Gillespie, who was first-team all-defense with Mark and Davion. When you have three guys that can really defend at that level, if the more aggressive type defense and man-to-man defense you play benefits your team, and that's what we what fit us best, and we were able to do. And I think, hence, when you can get some turnovers and get in transition, especially with a team as quick as us, it makes your offense even better. So our defense really fed into our offense this year as well. And with the rebounding, that's just something I think we pride ourselves in at Baylor, and our guys have really bought into.
Yeah, I mean, adjusted defense, KenPom fourth in the country, is, and obviously you're third in the KenPom rankings to end the year. You mentioned Vidal. He's just one of those guys who, I don't know, I don't think he's an NBA player, you know, because you got to be able to, but I wouldn't put it against him just because he's so competitive, right? And he's such an animal, you know, in and around the basket. What was the process like to get him to come to Baylor? He was a pretty heavily recruited player. What was that like?
Well, Mark's somebody we've had a long time relationship with. Maybe it was his freshman, sophomore year. I mean, he came to Baylor for the first time, and that was before the rules where freshmen couldn't come to campus, and young guys like that couldn't come. But he was somebody that we'd had some great players, Tweety Carter, Lace Darius Dunn, Rico Gathers from Louisiana, and Mark was somebody that respected those guys, knew those guys. And Mark's similar to some of those guys from the standpoint everybody in the state knew him, because I think it was in eighth grade he was dunking on people down there, and he was one of those guys that was just bigger than a lot of people, grew at an earlier age, and his athleticism was known throughout the state. And then he's somebody that basketball-wise and skill-wise has always continued to improve and get better, and he's an elite passer. He really passes the ball well. He's an unselfish player, but Mark's greatest quality is his toughness and his motor and his desire to win. And from that, you never have to worry about if a ball's on the floor, who's going to come up with it. Very similar to Rico Gathers, if the ball's on the floor, you know he's coming down with it 9 out of 10 times, and or he's getting it 9 out of 10 times. And what Mark does is translates to winning. And I know you mentioned, was he an NBA player? And that's the great thing about Mark, is each and every year he's been at Baylor, he's improved in some area, and he continues to improve in different areas. And eventually he's somebody that I think will have a chance to play in the NBA, because everybody wants a defensive stopper. Everybody wants somebody who can move the ball. Everyone wants a winner, wants a great teammate. So there's some people in the NBA. I mean, you remember Tony Allen was an unbelievable defender. Yep. And player for Oklahoma State. P.J. Tucker had some of that in him at Texas. And, again, I think Mark continues to get better and improve, and when it's all said and done at Baylor University, he's going to he has a chance maybe to become the all-time wins leader. I'll have to check and see that, because at the end of the year, we really couldn't get all those numbers because we had to get out of campus and everything. So once we're able to get back with the virus, we'll figure out all that stuff. But again, those are things that Mark just brings in. As you know, like, you were at the front of the defense, and Davion Mitchell at the front of our defense set the tone, and then Mark with his versatility to guard 1 through 5, and then Freddie protecting the rim, and everybody else on the team was motivated and improved because of that and really bought into that, and hence you have the fourth best defense in the country.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because so many teams have taken to this really loading up on the basketball. You're not necessarily pressuring the next pass. You guys really pressuring. You guys, obviously, versatility with Mark at the four and have rim protection is a little bit different, but your style was a little bit different and was really, really successful and took teams out of what they want to do, which kind of brings me to the last point, right? Everyone respected your zone, and then you had a couple. It wasn't like you had one zone. You had a couple different zone looks. Now you've shown the versatility several times in your career to be a very good man coach. The consistency of success is there. You're not doing it with the top five recruits in the country, and you're able to do it at Baylor, you know, a private school that's been through kind of their own issues in other areas of the university. It's really impressive. You've never, like, this is the most impressive thing to me. You've never lashed out when people have questioned you and your coaching like that, you know, never. Like, you smiled and taken the high road or whatever. How hard is that for you to not do that? Like, where does that, I mean, I know that some of that comes from your dad and your faith, but I've literally never heard you be snarky in any way. And you know, that's not my way. I would totally be snarky. You have not. How do you do that?
Well, everyone has their own talents and abilities, and I can tell you one thing, though. We're all human, and every one of us would rather be praised than criticized. So does it affect affects everybody different, bothers people different. At the end of the day, in sports, when you're in the arena, you're open to criticism, and everyone is entitled to their opinion. And I know the biggest thing is always what we say, control what we can control. And after each game, as a player, coach, I always say the number one thing is start with yourself. What could I have done better? And the day you can't improve yourself is the day you're not going to get better, and obviously the team's not going to get better. So I know after each game there's things I wish I'd do different, because you see they didn't work out. And I think my ability to, and when I say ability, to talk to my dad, talk to my brother, talk to other people that I trust in the profession and get their opinions and their support throughout the years, that obviously is helped things. I know early on, Coach Dale Brown really helped me out a lot, because he had his fair share of criticism, and his way of handling it was a little different too. He liked to fight back a little bit more, but it's great when you have people that you can confide in, and then if they agree, yeah, you should have done this and this and this, it makes it easier, and you know they're objective, and you know they love you, and they care about you, and they want you to, they want the best for you. But going back to the beginning, and that is I think any player would rather be told how good they are rather than criticized, and every coach is the same way, every human's the same way. So at the end of the day, you know, someone's going to win, someone's going to lose, and your job is just to do the best that you can and improve each day. And if you keep getting better, as you know, over time, things will take care of themselves.
One piece of advice you gave to Bryce. He's just taken a new job at Grand Canyon. Obviously, he did a great job at Valpo. And then at Vandy, it started out awesome, and then it did not end awesome, and it was like 3 years. It was bam. It was really quick. Did you talk about things that you can learn from. Was there anything you offered in terms of advice this time around for Bryce?
Well, I think first and foremost was making sure that they always say hire slow and fire fast, and I think hiring your staff as a coach is the most important thing. And I know he's in the middle of doing that. And then after that, it'll be a process of bringing in the players that fit his culture. But I know in coaching, again, you're only as good as your staff and your players. And you look at it when Darius Garland wasn't injured, I think they were undefeated. And if he doesn't get injured, the most important part, most important piece of any team is your point guard. And when he went out, obviously it really changed things for them. And it's kind of like if LeBron went out, or
no, they built the whole thing around him, right? And the guy's only a freshman, and then they go in the SEC, and we can let Bryce refight that battle. But it's a hard, okay. Here's last one, and then I'll let you go. I know you got to be the PE coach for your kids. Okay, you mentioned that anytime when you watch things, everybody can get better. One thing that you personally want to improve on from this year to next?
It's a good question. 'Cause there's several things that I want to get better at, but I don't know if I need to tell you them all. so we'll just keep it by the numbers. I think our assist to turnover ratio can definitely get better, and that will improve our offensive efficiency. The second thing that can get better is our free throw shooting down the stretch wasn't near what we were capable of. We should have been a 75% to 80% free throw shooting team, and that's got to get fixed, or get back to where it should be. And then the third thing with that, defensively, I know we did some different things this year, and we instilled a lot of different stuff. So as a coach, you never want to throw in too much. You want to, whatever you do, you want to do well. I think with the personnel being somewhat similar, we'll be able to add some more things to the defense to even make it more effective now, because it's kind of like once you put the foundation in, now you can start adding floors and layers to things. And since we don't have a lot of turnover, we'll be able to do that. And that's why most people have us predicted top five, depending on what happens or transpires with other teams and our guys.
Well, can I offer one outside perspective on a thought?
Absolutely.
Okay, so here's
First
my
of
thought.
All, you never
so,
normally ask. You just give it.
I do, but it's a podcast, I'll pretend. This is, so instead of sending you a text, hey, I saw this, I think your program has turned the corner from trying to, because I don't think the common fan, and common fans probably might not listen to this podcast. There's a lot of hoop guys, right? We got like 100,000 downloads, so some of them, I think the common fan doesn't realize how big winning the league is. And it's big in any league, but in the Big 12, because Kansas has done what they've done, you're so focused on winning the league. But I do think that during your season, because now you are transitioning from a team that you want to win the league to one that, hey, you got a chance to win the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a conversation I had with Tony Bennett after the UMBC loss, which is, I think you should take different moments during the year to try things, whether it's a different defensive look, different defense, different offensive, different lineups as well, because what I felt like happened to you, you guys were so good. You know, you have three or four guys and go get buckets, and then a guy, you know, one or two guys that can get it off the rim if they miss. And slowly, like you said, people were adjusting to you, and you had yet to make the adjustment to their adjustment. I almost feel like you throw, maybe not artificial adversity towards you, but instead of focusing on winning every game, doesn't mean you don't want to win the game, but spend time in the first half to throw in a different lineup, because, you know, Mark gets in foul trouble at TCU, right? How can you play left-handed? Because you're gonna when you get to the NCAA tournament, somebody's gonna get sick, somebody's gonna get hurt, somebody's gonna foul trouble, and you may have some lineup, and you almost, instead of trying to preparing to win just the Big 12, think about what it's gonna take to win six games in March. And I would say, take a chance at the 1-3-1 that you had only taken a look at in practice. Take a chance at playing Mayer, the tall white kid who's bouncy. Like, look at him at the five and play five out and see what that looks like. Like, that's just an idea from my side. To one, I think it will, some of those guys that got set into their roles of being the bench, it'll reinvigorate them. But two, it'll give you the confidence to give me the confidence to try something, to not be in, not be, oh shit, we are in foul trouble. What do we do? Yeah. No, we know what we're going to do. We're going to switch to this lineup and everybody starts nodding their head. That would be my out, completely outside, uneducated on what actually goes inside your coach's office.
Well, actually, it's pretty educated if you gave it to Tony after the first round loss and then they won the national championship. Well,
my thing with Tony was he's like, he you know, he was so down. He's so down on himself, and he felt like he let the kids down more than anything. And he's like, you know, we didn't have Hunter, and the court really shrinks. And I was like, well, had you tried to play small without DeAndre Hunter before? He's like, no. He's like, why would I? I was like, because, you know, this is, and, you know, he had lineups, and I also thought the blocker mover is great, and it's great to fall back on. But I said, you know, you need to challenge yourself to some new offensive ideas because you have, you know, different weaponry. And I mean, like, I didn't tell him to go and run ball screen continuity, but he did. He ran some NBA sets. I mean, look, you guys are all magnificent coaches. And it doesn't mean that any one thing. I would just suggest that every NCAA tournament I've played in, something goes wrong or something goes amiss. And teams that are prepared for it, or kids that figure it out, or a guy steps up and makes shots, those are the teams that win. Because
that's a great point. So, all right, next year when we do one of those things and we lose a game, don't get on the air and criticize me, though, will you?
That's okay. Listen, that's okay. It's okay, though, if in your mind you're like, because you can go in the locker room and you can just tell your guys, like, hey, look, guys, that one's on me. I tried some things. I screwed it up. Knowing in your mind that maybe it's not even on you because you're play the long game. Like, you're not getting fired at Baylor next year. You're going to be good at the end of the year next year. You know, what's it going to take to be great? And maybe what it takes to be great is when you play Kansas in the Big 12 tournament, you show them you're able to go to a lineup that they can't adjust to. You know what I mean?
And you're 100% right about that as far as people sick, injured, foul trouble, something's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, and the ones that can adjust. Listen, I marvel at what you've been able to do and how consistently you've been able to do it. You have a lot of fans in my industry and how you've consistently been able at Baylor to do it and do it the right way. I really appreciate your time. Now go be the most highly paid, highly sought after PE coach in the history of Waco public coronavirus schooling.
Hey, I appreciate that. Just do me a favor. Give your son a hug because I saw the handles in the video you sent. We're going to be recruiting him one day, all right? So make sure he knows that too.
we'll do it. We're out. We got PE coming up as well. Thanks so much for joining me. Hey, thanks, Scott.
Thank you. Appreciate it, sir.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
That was awesome to catch up with Coach Drew. A reminder, we have all kinds of guests on the Doug Gottlieb Show, weekdays, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. You can download the podcast. Like, I had Bill Self on for 20 minutes last week. Download that one. Really, really good. Apparently, Bill Self has become the most expensive cleaner of garages in the history of Lawrence, Kansas. That's the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Make sure you download, subscribe, and rate. Tell a friend about us. Tweet it out. Tell them, hey, this is what really makes Scott Drew tick. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.